Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who doesn't have any eyebrows. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I'm a curiously redundant vestige of my previous use as bouillabaisse.
Yum, yum.
And yum, yum indeed, as we head to the cafes of Paris, the city of death.
Hooray, it's Grey Paris.
Possibly more accurately called City That Has Some Death In It.
It was raining.
Well, just before you start off, Nathan, because I may forget to mention this, some of you out there may know, if you follow me on Facebook, that I have an album called Toys on Tour. I've recently uploaded some photos I took ages ago where I took a Tom Baker toy to Paris.
Oh.
And I found the gallery where the TARDIS is parked, and I found the door to Scaroth's chateau. So, yeah, expect some Toys on Tour shots in Paris accompanying this podcast.
They're nice toys. You can show your grandmother.
Well, so this is absolute shit, isn't it? Really terrible. Tiresome.
Is there anything that's wrong with this? Let's start. That is actually a good point to start. What is wrong with this show?
I actually think it is the best story so far.
In Doctor Who?
Yep.
Yeah, it's the most fun.
At this point. But it's not just that it's fun, and all of that stuff we talked about in last week's episode about the chemistry between Lala and Tom, and having Lala, Tom and Douglas all together on the show. That's one aspect of it, and it's a hugely important aspect because Douglas has written the thing. All of the dialogue just sings. There's just funny line after funny line after funny line. So all of that element's there. But it's also really, really tightly plotted. You know, there's nothing wasted, everything's paid off. Douglas eventually, you know, when he starts writing the Dirk Gently novels, his books are like, his plots rather, are like puzzle boxes. You know, everything just sort of slots into place really well. And you can see that happening here. It happens to a lesser extent in The Pirate Planet. And then you've just got, we're in Paris, we're actually shooting overseas, there's stacks of outdoor stuff, stacks of stuff on film, just Tom and Lala running hand in hand through the streets of Paris.
With Duggan.
With Duggan, obviously. is just wonderful fun to watch. Dudley's on form, it's well directed.
Isn't Dudley on form?
He's terrific.
And it is well directed. Everyone felt like, you could feel that everyone was having a great time. It was a holiday for everybody, not just a holiday for the Doctor.
Well, the funny thing is, do you want to know who it wasn't a holiday for? Because at the time this was in, production, Destiny of the Daleks was in pre-production. So in Paris, you had Tom Baker, Lala Ward, Tom Shadbon, who plays Duggan. You had Graham Williams, you had the director Michael Hayes, and a small film crew. So one camera guy, two sound guys, I think. So the noticeable name absent from there is co-writer Douglas Adams, who was back in England minding the fort.
For how long, though?
I believe they were in Paris for about 5 days.
You know what really happened, don't you? With Kenny.
With Ken Grieve. Ken Grieve came in to have a meeting with Graham Williams, and Douglas Adams said, well, look, they've all gone to Paris. And Ken Grieve said, well, you know, you and I can only get so much done without the producer here. You know, we can't decide locations and props and what have you. And he's like, oh, yeah. Oh, do you want to go for lunch? Yeah, okay, let's go for lunch. Where should we go for lunch? How about Paris? And so they got on the train and went to Paris and really became good mates, and they stayed friends until Douglas Adams
and
died.
Got chucked out of the same place that Tom and Lala and Doug and the rest of the crew were having lunch just a few hours afterwards, and said, thrown out and said, where can we go? There's a bar open in West Berlin. They were in West Berlin and they got back to the London studios just a few hours before the other lot came in.
Yes.
Not a lot happened that week.
Graham Williams saw them in Paris and was so annoyed. He's like, you're meant to be back in London working. And to which Douglas apparently said something along the lines of, well, so are you.
There must have been
go down too well.
There must have been some kind of impending writing deadline hanging over Douglas's head for him to go to those lengths.
But that's true, actually. He was the great procrastinator. But no, apparently Williams wrote this story with Douglas as well.
It wasn't entirely... Absolutely. Of course, it was originally a David Fisher story called A Gamble with Time, set in 1930s Monte Carlo,
set then in 1930s Roger Moore. Paris. I think set in Roger Moore and Tony Curtis. There was an episode of The Persuaders. It was going to be one of those ITC kind of shows where there's a few little moments of in Paris, but it was all going to be a back lot and some studio sets and set in the 20s Paris. But they realised when they got there, well, is that, you know why it's all in Paris? Because John Nathan Turner, Counter, said it's actually... slightly, it was £25 cheaper to do the whole thing there than do the show that they'd started. £25.
Well, yeah. I mean, part of the rewrite was that we could spend all this money making it look like 1930s, or we can go to Paris and just have it look fabulous and still be 1979, and we can still have this time travel aspect. The other thing was it was to be set in a casino, and then Graham Williams went cold on the casino idea because he didn't like the idea of promoting gambling to children.
Oh.
So, you know, this is another example of Graham Williams being very plot-driven, for instance.
I think that might have been a 13th hour thing, because Williams was very good at playing... the producers, and there's, you know, producers will always do it. There's a story, a posteriori from the event. So it was the Thursday that it changed, and the shooting was the Monday. So
he had no qualms about promoting art forgery to children.
But to his great credit, David Fisher looked at the final script and said, look, this is wonderful, but please, I can't put my name on it. It's not right. I'll do you another story. So he did Creature from the Pit and started developing a story called The Famasi, but we'll get to that. So, yeah, we have a script written by Douglas Adams and Graham Williams, credited to David Agnew. And God, hasn't David Agnew gotten much better at plotting since The Invasion of Time? But yeah, it is wonderful. I'd like to quote, if I may, from the Discontinuity Guide. So Cornell, Day and Topping.
Yep.
This is their bottom line for The City of Death. Witty, happy, plotted so hard that you can sing it. This is as gorgeous as This Old Heart of Mine, sung by the Isley Brothers outside your window on a spring morning, while Emma Thompson gently massages your feet with aromatic oils.
That's Cornell.
But you know what? I read that, and as a gay man, I go, you know what? I'd be very happy to. Mainly because, you know, you get to chat with Emma Thompson.
I know.
And of course, Emma Thompson was, I believe, a friend of Douglas Adams as well.
Wasn't everyone?
Yes. Mm. And as they finish off, just when you think it can't get any better, John Bloody Cleese turns up.
It's not just John Bloody Cleese, though. It's Eleanor Bron.
And as the lines illustrate its vestigial function.
She's wonderful. She's just terrific in it. She's, funnier than him. And it is... it's such a surprise. It's such an incredible surprise little cameo.
And I feel so sorry that they didn't go with John's wish to be credited under a pseudonym. Because John said, look, the whole joke is that I'm there and it's a cameo. If you credit me as John Cleese in the Radio Times, people are going to know.
Yeah.
Oh, so was he credited?
He was credited in the Radio Times and in the credits. He asked to be credited as Kim Bread. And I think maybe if he'd gone for Jonathan Smith or something like that, which is a slight in joke, but I think maybe if he'd gone for that, David Reed would have said, yeah, okay. But in the end, David Reed said, no, we're not calling you Kim Bread, that's just stupid. He should have asked to be credited as Robin Bland, really.
Yeah.
Or David Agnew.
Or John Cheese.
John Cheese, yes. Even better.
Should be terrible.
What do you praise first is the question in this story. Because coming back to Richard's original question, I can't criticise anything.
The elongated running arounds with absolutely nothing happening. But
who cares, though? Do you know what I mean? Television's visual, that stuff creates the atmosphere that we praise.
I'm about to remove my Julian mask and have Nathan underneath, and Nathan's about to move his mask and have me underneath.
Oh, yeah, because I'm being so relentlessly positive. So Julian Glover is unbelievably good in it, like just fantastic.
As John Travolta in his Saturday Night Fever white disco suit.
That's right.
With a suit, but even that idea, and maybe it's the first time Doctor Who's done it, where you have hideous green tentacled monster with a lovely cravat. I think that's just terrific, and it's the sort of thing that Doctor Who now does as, routine. Mm. But I think it's the first time we have it here. I think it's just terrific. I love his silk dressing gown thing that he threatens Kerensky in a bit later on. He's really funny and tremendously good, like one of the best villains we've ever had. That first scene where Tom and Duggan and Romana come round to his place and, you know, Duggan tries to hit him with a chair and all of that sort of thing, all of that dialogue is just spectacularly good, just unbelievably funny.
I just wish that when they'd come home that Glover had still been in his mother's dressing gown aping the performance of Peter Cook as Sherlock Holmes in drag in the Paul Morrissey Hound of the Baskervilles. Paul Morrissey was Warhol's filmmaker, but he went to England and did a spoof version of Hound of the Baskervilles with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore as Watson. And Holmes is Jewish and terribly camp in full makeup and hair curlers and his mother's dressing gown. And Watson is Welsh, and Kenneth Williams is Lord Baskerville. And Irene Handel is one of the women with a dog that an incontinent dog that in her garden. It's one of the greatest films of all time, and possibly my pick of the week. But the humour that imbues this right. story as well.
Oh, I haven't seen that, but I'm looking forward to finding it through Nathan's show notes.
But you've almost got. We've almost got. It's actually really hard to track down. We've almost got that level of humour, of self-lampoon in this. And there are many reasons why this shouldn't work. Because when you're having that much fun, you said it last week when we were recording, that Brendan, that everyone has fun except the audience. And there's always a danger. But yeah. I don't think we get that in this one, do we?
No. The performance that's closest to a caricature, I guess, is Kerensky.
And yet...
That's, of course...
The accent?
Yeah, yeah. Accent? Well, that's...
You know the story?
It's David Graham, isn't
it's
it?
Parker, it's Parker from Thunderbirds.
But one of the original Daleks.
The original Dalek, and that's his maternal grandparents' actual accent. He said, they were Russian Jews, and they actually sounded just like that. I'm not going to do the accent.
It is an accent. It is, you know, but it's not really comedy accent.
But he's playing it as a character, as a Thunderbirds puppet. Hyperbole humour, but that works because and the balance, I think it just ups the menace of Scaroff.
Even Duggan too, do you know what I mean, who's a bit of an idiot, and you know his character thing is that he breaks glass and he punches people in the head and stuff, and you know he is desperately earnest and not very bright, but again that's allowed to work because he's the one who actually saves humanity by punching someone in the head, which is precisely what the doctor's been telling him not to do.
Notes came from MacDonald. You know, was it Graham MacDonald who was the head of Sirius? And he was a no-fun zone. A lot of things that he was arguing against. But one of the notes that came down to Williams and Adams was there's too much hitting in this story. The chair leg, the whole thing was cut out. Then Tom was, you know, with the Louis Kahn's chair, but there was a scene with Tom doing the same thing that was cut. And I have to agree with him that at the time, Duggan was a real lodestone of dullness in this for me, and he still is. This isn't perfect.
I like him paired with Romana in the cafe in the evening after they escape from the Louvre.
Yeah.
And they have that lovely chat and do you know what I don't understand? Yes, I expect so.
Of course, it always gives Lana a wonderful opportunity, but it's kind of, they're easy punches, aren't they?
Pun intended.
Yeah.
The violence in terms of Duggan, I do kind of see where you're coming from, because of course Duggan is presented as an heroic character, but I think what helps in a way is not only does the Doctor comment on it, but for instance in the scene where the Countess Scarleone is trying to shoot them and Duggan hits her with a vase, he's genuinely apologetic that he's hit a lady. You know, so he does have some scruples. And of course, he's a hangover from when the story was set in the 30s. He's Bulldog Drummond in the 1930s, but just set in the 1970s. So of course, he doesn't quite fit in. I think it's also a comment on shows like The Professionals, for instance, which was all brute force. And you've got the Doctor and Romana saving the day by being hilariously witty and put
by being Steed and Mrs. Peel. That first opening scene with them is a complete, feels like an exact
You know, it's a bouquet. It's Rig and McNee, isn't it?
And you know what? When they're running away from the tower, you can just imagine that ding 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 yes. ding 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 yes. ding ding ding. You know what? I may redub that.
They're so amazingly smart. They're so brilliant. Everything that they say is a bombo. Every comeback, you know, they outwit Duggan all the time in conversation, you know, and they pride themselves on being smart. It's the whole, you know, this season has a, you know, has a bouquet, and it's just them being immensely clever. And so to have Duggan defeat the enemy and not them is just perfect.
Yeah.
I think it is, but why is Duggan punching people worse than canine zapping people?
A good point, because it's easier to copy, because it comes from a human, because
it's real violence as opposed to fake.
And there is the trouble with Tom this season that we'll get to on precisely that point. But Duggan doesn't fit. He's so much the opposite of the two leads that it ends up being just a point of inertia.
I like his performance, actually. I really do.
I like Tom Chadman.
He's got some charm, you know.
Yeah.
And Tom Chadman's certainly proven his worth on other things.
Well, so. Like The Mysterious Planet.
Yeah, not that he needs to prove it to us. He's terrific. All that day glow on that helmet.
Yeah, wonderful.
I used to do divorce investigations. Never anything like this. He's wonderful. I mentioned her earlier, Catherine Schell. Fresh from Space 1939.
That's right.
And rather interestingly, you know, in Space 1939, she was sort of an animal in human form.
Oh, it's so awful.
But now
awful,
she's married to an animal in human form instead.
Oh, yes.
She isn't wearing the giant sideburns that she...
Or the...
the brown ears
Or the herpes-like eyebrows that she...
Awful. Yeah.
But
awful.
Look, when we were 10, 12, it was terrific.
No, it wasn't. I remember being crushed with disappointment when a season 2 episode of Space 1999 came on. Where's that lovely set? Who's that terrible woman?
Brian Blessed.
Where's Muffet? Oh, sorry.
That's the wrong show.
Professor Watson. What was his name? Victor. Where's Victor?
Yeah, I loved Victor.
Because, you know, he looks like Muffet.
Oh, I see. She's fantastic. What do we think... Like, I do remember people speculating about the nature of the Count and Countess's marriage, given that she seemed to be unaware...
What else have I been doing all these years?
Yes, what else have I been doing?
So, I think we know exactly what's going on. It's just terribly discreet.
Yeah.
Do you think?
They have a perfect French marriage, which means that, you know, she loves wealth and to be seen on the arm of a handsome gentleman. He also likes the company of other handsome gentlemen, and that's terribly exotic. And
she probably has Herman doing for her, actually.
Actually, yeah.
Herman actually works really well if you want to relive this in the privacy of your own playroom, Brendan, with a Roger Delgado master figure, and you just white up his hair. He's, you know, he's perfect as Herman.
I do fancy Herman a bit.
It's the gloves.
But I will note that, you know, there could be a different reading to Count Scaglione's line about, you know, it hasn't taken much to fool you. A few trinkets, a bit of nefarious excitement. Mm. He didn't say that he was the provider
of the nefarious excitement.
He might have just been turning the other way.
I thought she assumed he was gay.
I'm assuming that too. Yeah.
Every man must have a hobby. She gets very defensive when he's in the company of other men.
He does. She does, doesn't she? Yes. There's that scene of she's not
with that professor down in the cellar.
Yeah, with that professor of his.
There's plenty in that for everyone, isn't there?
So she assumes he likes some wizened old daddies.
I'm really surprised that they're all sets. The Louis Cannes Palazzo set, although we're in Paris, is a set.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. I assumed that they'd just done some Paris filming in one of their charms, but no, it's all sets. Only sets.
Paris W12.
Well, they would have only taken a film camera over.
And three cars.
They couldn't have shot videotape.
Copies, art copies.
This is something that Sandifer goes on about. The thing about art, there's something about scarcity and there's something about authenticity.
Are you talking about Walter Benjamin's Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction?
Yeah.
But, or Duchamp's taking, as Armut, taking a fountain and saying that this is now art because I've written Armut on the side of it.
Yeah,
or, you know,
yeah.
Or is it goes back to Rembrandt. Rembrandt's students painted he was the first Warhol. He barely touched the stuff.
He was just sort of lying back, saying, make that guy look out at the viewer.
Yeah, he was one of the first, he was the first art entrepreneur, he had a factory.
So you get all that stuff about computer paintings, you get all that stuff about rarity and scarcity. And this thing, which I thought was really terrible as a kid and now I think it's spectacular, where the only surviving Mona Lisa has the words "this is a fake" written in felt tip under the paint. I just think it's spectacularly great.
Mm. Has anyone heard of Vincenzo Perugia?
No one, not even his mother has heard.
Vincenzo Perugia stole the Mona Lisa in 1911 by sticking it under his smock, and he had it for 2 weeks.
It is a very pretty painting.
It is a very pretty painting.
I hope it wasn't under his smock for 2 weeks.
And it wasn't really, stop it, wasn't really valued. It was one of the huge hoards. Lots of stuff was brought back by Napoleon, the first Napoleon.
Right.
With his old nick and spree. But it wasn't really, but people for those 2 weeks in Paris 1911 was queuing up to look at the blank spot on the wall.
Where had it been?
Apparently, they really were. That, I think, is what Adams is really getting right here. And there's some really, really clever meta going on about what Doctor Who is and what television is and what art is. And are we making art? Well, I think we actually are. You kids are sitting watching this and your family folk at home and you're thinking this is a lovely romp or this is another ITC Persuaders Saint spy show over, or this is a lovely thing with, you know, some BBC character actors whom you've all enjoyed. But we're actually talking about a whole lot of things on what television is and what art is and what fun is. It's perfectly spelt out what this season is doing, and it dovetails beautifully, I should say, with the development of the character of Romana. And you adroitly pointed out last episode that this is where Romana discovers her humanity. In this one, she discovers her humanity in the social sense, or in the sense of how she responds to a world. When she says, most tellingly, well, computers can draw.
Yeah.
She actually gets the whole point of this story is the second iteration of where we're going to end up with Sharda. It's the most socialist series, not communistic, socialist series that Doctor Who has ever done, because it's smarty-pants socialism. It is everyone has the right to be the best that they can possibly be, but on their own individual merit and their own individual terms. It is not about perceived or procured wealth from outside. It is not about how much you can get. It is not about what you can acquire. It is not about how many iterations of the same thing you can get. They always end up being the baddies. We'll see it with Adrasta. We'll see it. We've seen it with Davros, and we're going to see it further along the line, all the way through the season. This is the story where Romana very gently is introduced to what it is to be an individual in a culture where individualism is prominent, and that is France. France has booted all of this right from the revolution. Did you want to throw that in now? I just wanted to hear your Vicky.
Revolution!
Thank you!
This story is, as you say, it's a love letter to all those things. It's a love letter to art, it's a love letter to the personal response of art, and it's an indictment of a version of the collector mentality. Mm. Now, we're fans, you as listeners are probably fans as well, and I imagine we all have a collection to some degree or another. Now, what this script is talking about, it's loving the people who collect because the objects mean something to them. Now, when I was living in the UK, I snapped up every Doctor Who action figure I could. And then it came time when I was looking at some of them and I was thinking, mostly the new series ones, so, you know, things like the Scarecrows from Human Nature, Family of Blood, and the Slitheen and Space Pig. I kind of looked at them and went, I've got all these, but I've also got the Fendal, and I've got the Vok, and I've got the Sea Devil. And those last three, they're the ones I have a personal response to, and I'm happy when I see them on the shelf. The others, it's kind of like, it's nice to have them. They're very well put together, and I don't blame anyone for whom, you know, that's your first monster and you love that monster.
Are you saying you weren't collecting Doctor Who action figures for the individuation of your own wealth and power in the world?
He was doing it so that he could finance time travel experiments.
Okay, but that's the thing.
Down the line. There's a difference between that and doing it just for the sake of putting yourself up in society. I don't think anyone buys Doctor Who action figures to give themselves prominence in culture.
No, exactly. So I ended up getting rid of the ones that didn't give me that frisson of, oh my God, I can't believe I own this. But and I used that to buy more of the classic ones.
We have knowledge before we have wealth, and Romana and the Doctor will always be infinitely more wealthy than anyone they come across, even though they only ever have a few centimes in their pockets, because they have the wealth of themselves and their experience and their wit.
Yeah. Enough money to buy a bouillabaisse.
They do seem, I don't think they even pay. Did you notice the thugs? In the first script, the thugs have to pay for the glasses of water. Because in France, you still have to pay for water.
But it just struck me that we're talking about copies of the Mona Lisa being produced, but of course there is a moment in the cafe where the TV is showing a picture of the Mona Lisa, and presumably TVs all over Paris are as well. And so, you know, everyone has a little copy of the Mona Lisa in their home at that one moment. And it is that thing where Scaglione would think that the Doctor was being naive when he talked about what the painting looks like. The Doctor's line, it's a very pretty painting, which is...
Probably.
Why do people want to steal the Mona Lisa? It's a very pretty painting. Of course that's not the reason.
It's not because
it's a very pretty painting. It's because it's unique and because it has this provenance, because it's fetishized.
Fetishizing is it. It's a cathecting of the object, as Freud says. It's the love object. It's having to possess that which is no longer possessible, is the love of the parent. So, you know, they want to own it because they and possessing it. It's why it's the void that can never be filled. They keep needing to acquire. It's some really high concept stuff in this.
Yeah.
But it's all coming down. It's actually coming down to, you could see it as an ecological thing. This season is about possessions and why you really want them. Romana and the Doctor don't really have very much.
Yeah,
but they have themselves.
And there is nothing intrinsically bad about wanting possessions. And I think that's why...
I think the season actually says there is. I think that's exactly what this story is about.
But it is your purpose in wanting them.
Yeah, I don't think Doctor... I think, honestly, yeah, four parts about copying Doctor Who action figures would probably not have had the same.
Well,
they didn't have them then, did they? Only Dennis Fisher.
To give you an example of something recent, Richard, you were having a look at the photos before of my little Nintendo things that you can scan into the system. Yes. They're called Amiibos. They came out about a year ago, and there was a shortage of them. Nintendo weren't expecting such huge demand, which meant people were walking into Kmart and Target, and soon as stock were coming in, just arm across the shelf, all into their basket, buying them for 17 a pop and selling them for 50.
Ooh.
And that is exactly what Scaglione is doing here. Of course, you know, he's doing it with something slightly more important than Nintendo figures. He's doing it with Gutenberg Bibles.
Yeah, you're right, it's the same thing. Yeah.
But
do we do that next week as well? Like, isn't Creature from the Pit all about economy and scarcity?
It's even more so, yes. And it gets hammered home next season. There'll be lots of metallic references. Only the first.
Yeah, but that's the thing. In a way, Scaroff, is the oldest human who ever lived, because he's been human in all these different points in history, but he just doesn't get it.
There's no evolution there, is there?
Exactly.
He may live for a long time, but he doesn't mutate, he doesn't change.
Do you know, we haven't mentioned perhaps the most important guest role in the entire story. It's Packer! Packer is back.
Peter Halliday.
Halliday is back.
It's one of the guards. That's right.
Yeah, he's the guard for Captain Tancredi, and that is
Captain Tancredi.
He's also one of the Jagaroth voices in the opening credits.
As is Tom Chadbourne.
The other one's Tom Chadbourne. Yeah, yeah.
Peter Halliday was the go-to guy to be voices in the '60s, wasn't he? Mm. He was the Nicholas Briggs of the 1960s.
Yeah.
It's such a small part, you know, like. Packer is in it for 8 episodes. He's got a huge amount to do. Here, Peter Halliday is just at the end of, episode 3 and the beginning of episode 4.
Yes.
And he's really terrific. He's just terribly good. He doesn't steal a scene away from Tom, but he's really tremendously charming. And, like, something changes. That cliffhanger isn't the Doctor so much in peril as, oh my God, something very different is going on from what we think. It's not just an alien trying to steal the Mona Lisa. Something much, much more complex is going on. It's a really good moment.
Yeah, and I love how 45 years later, we still haven't met Leonardo da Vinci on screen. You know,
and we never should.
He's mentioned in Mask of Mandragora. Mm. We think we're going to meet him here and we don't. I'm pretty sure it's been mentioned in the new series. But it's such a Doctor Who and Douglas Adams thing to do, and it kind of comes back to what you were saying, Richard. You know, people might have been sitting there going, oh, we're going to meet Leonardo da Vinci. No, instead we're going to have a very, very funny but at the same time very tense and scary bit with just three actors sitting in a room.
Yeah.
This series is, I think, what Graham Williams always wanted to do, and it just took him a while to get there. He's trying to make Doctor Who a big sci-fi blockbuster with great special effects in his first year and realised he couldn't do that. And then he tried to do a story arc, and that sort of collapsed in on itself at the end. So here he's doing a series of self-contained adventures, but linked by a common theme.
And I think, you know, recognising that his strengths are going to lie in the quality of the writing and, you know, just getting compelling, if not good, actors, you know, to say the lines. And if you can manage to make the sets beautiful, which unfortunately in season 17 you almost never can, just so much the better. But yeah, I think, you know, this is where that whole approach just pays off in spades.
Now, hopefully he's not going to try and take off on warp drive, but here's a little obelisk we've got hovering over our heads.
It's a double inverted octahedron.
Mm. No, it's just an octahedron. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I was never any good at geometry.
She is, though, because she gets the 2.73 by 6 metres.
That is such a funny line, though, what Scarlet Can
we? You know where that's from, don't you? The 1905 Arthur Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes story. I keep wanting to say Northanger Abbey. Do you remember the name of the story? Anyway, Holmes works it out by... There's something... It's very Poe, really, but the fourth room, by noticing the inside dimensions are different from the outside dimensions.
And she's walking up and down with the thing, saying the... Like, measuring the thing in metres and stuff. I actually really love how she's off investigating things while the Doctor is, you know, being a dick.
She's carrying explosives. Don't you want to see what Romana's doing? It looks terribly interesting. Yeah, she's here to blow the brick wall down.
It's quite
interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's why she's dressed as a St. Trinian student in this.
Because she's a naughty girl.
She's a Bakuninist. She just wants to blow up the establishment.
I do love how she sort of said in later interviews, you know, people wrote in and said, oh, you're dressing as a schoolgirl. I never thought of that, and I don't see why anyone should think of schoolgirls in that way. Thank you, gentlemen. She just cuts that down.
You know why she said, you know why she said right to. At the time, she did it because... They wanted her. They had. Do you know the story? The costume that they had been designed for her was a silver Lurex one-piece catsuit. Haven't we been here before? Perhaps.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's mind robber again.
Well, but they were still designing for Mary, weren't they?
Well, they were designing for
Mary's
Zoe.
Mary's not going to wear a Lurex catsuit.
They were designing for Wendy Padbury in 1968. But anyway, that was the concept. And Lana said, "No, I hated school. Brenda's already pointed it out. Let's make what we dislike." We own. Let's turn it around and love it. The feminist movement had already brought this in. Mm-hmm. What most oppresses you, possess it and make it your own.
And so is her outfit in Leisure Hive about how much she hated her time in the Navy?
Absolutely. Or as a Pinocchio doll or whatever it was that she was forced to be. That's a perfect costume. When's the actual figure coming out? Yeah. It's perfect.
Yeah, no,
and she really wears it well. And there's some really clever moments where you can see there's the three of them working together where she's being a horribly clever schoolgirl and doing precocious things. And, oh, look, there's me. I've just opened the Chinese puzzle box because you told me not to. Yeah, and lots of things through this.
She's in Paris. It's Madeleine.
Yeah.
Oh, it is too. Just draw me like one of your French girls. She says.
Anyway, sorry to keep you waiting, Tom, but we were talking about Lala.
So here we are at the City of Death, the much lauded City of Death, or as David Fisher likes to call it, 35% of the gamble with time. Look, there's no denying that this is a great script, great performances, there's certainly a panache to it, but Scarath dies at the end. But does that automatically kill all of his other versions through time? Are they still working to the same end? And how many times can Scarath be knocked out? I guess you'll want my head on a platter for actually suggesting that this may not be the most perfect story of all time. I guess I should jump into this giant hole that just opened up in the ground next to me. We call it the pit!
They seem to be a gestalt of one entity, though, don't they?
There is an explanation. I can't remember what it is in the novelisation. So there's a recent novelisation by...
The lovely Gareth?
No.
No, James Goss.
James Goss,
that's right.
Did it.
Yeah,
which is why I haven't bought it. Yes.
Yeah, it's really good.
But it's not Gareth.
No, it is really good. I was a little bit disappointed because I did like the Sharda novelisation. We'll talk more about that later. And I thought, oh, you know, I didn't know who James Goss was, to be honest.
For listeners of a similar bent who aren't quite sure who James Goss is and his Doctor Who connections...
What did you call me?
Silla. called you Silla Bent.
Silla Bent. There we go.
That'll stick.
James Goss produced... Scream of the Shulker.
Yeah. He did too.
He also produced the Invasion animations for episodes 1 and 4. He's done lots of Doctor Who things since then, and novels and books and comics and what have you. And presently he is, I believe, one of the producers on Big Finish's Dark Shadows range, which has won several awards.
Right.
So, you know, he's got, he does have his chops, but you're right in that a lot of people, fans of the older series, may not know who he is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was this
incredibly passionate fan.
You know, there was this association between season 17 and Gareth Roberts because of things like The Romance of Crime and The Well-Mannered War and those various missing adventures he set during that period. He's got an essay called Tom the Second, I think, in License Denied, which is this sort of very full-throated defence of the Williams era.
Thank you for bringing that up. There's a great essay in that one, which came out years ago, dear listener, of just a collection of essays that Paul Cornell cobbled together, of how good, when there was the revival of in fandom of love for the Williams series, and it was there's an essay in it, Why We Should Love the Nymon. Do you remember that essay? Anyway, we'll get to that further down.
But go on. So I had just wanted him to do it. James Goss's novelization is really terribly, terribly good, though.
Okay. And does it add new things?
Yes, yeah. So it is a very, very faithful novelization. It doesn't always use the versions of the script or the line readings that made their way into the transmitted version. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he'll pick a different reading, which I think is interesting. You know, it adds something. I cannot, if I want to relive a scene, any scene at all in City of Death, I can just close my eyes for a few minutes and, you know, I've got it memorized. That adds something new. He adds stuff about what it's like for Scaroth to experience his life now that he's been split in time. And in fact, the cliffhanger to episode 1, he has to give a reason for it because it's a novel. He can't just have the character go down and tear his face off because we're 24 minutes into the episode and it's about time something scary happened. So he has Scarlioni not fully aware that he's an alien. And so his face is itching, and it's almost like he's as surprised as we are to see the sort of green thing underneath. And so all that's really good. And he adds a hilarious extra depth to the John Cleese and Eleanor Bron characters who don't just appear in a cameo. It's terrific. It really is great.
My thought, because, yeah, I never really thought about what happened to his past splinters until this moment. And I think it's the argument we get in the new series, in that they've already lived and died to lead up to this moment. You know, they're not reacting to anything that happens any differently, because, as the Doctor says, it always happened, it always has to happen. You know, you can't do it, you can't change it. Now, obviously, he can change it, otherwise the Doctor wouldn't try to stop him. But the Doctor has always stopped him, and those past incarnations have always worked towards essentially nothing.
You don't actually have to be quite as timey-wimey as that, though, do you? I mean, the only one of the incarnations, the one in 1979, he's the only one with technology available to him to create the time machine. And that's what he says, you know, to have this limited level of technology available to me now in 1979, you know, all my other selves have worked and stuff. So once he's gone, there's no one far enough in the future to have access to time travel technology.
Yeah,
so that they can't do anything.
Maybe they don't know what's happened. He's just disappeared.
Isn't he
they
the
can't
last of the splinters?
Him. Yeah, yeah.
He's the most future splinter.
Yeah, he's the futuriest one, which is why he's the one who has the technology.
Although you do get the one in the Norman helmet, which is made out of tinfoil. And as a kid, I always thought he was in the future because he was covered in tinfoil. And that's the thing. As a child, I'm like, why is the one in 1979 doing all the technical stuff? This guy's wearing tinfoil. He must be from the future.
Didn't you
but
think
no, it wasn't like that.
Exactly. Didn't you think that if he's got a holographic projector that's as clever as that, he'd be the richest man on earth? Steve Jobs didn't have that in 79.
Yeah, that's true.
Why does he need the paintings anyway? He's a narrow-focused, to continue the projector metaphor, narrow-focused, naughty person, isn't he? Like all greedy collectors, they can only see through the camera obscura of their own little pinprick of light.
See, now I'm just envisioning comic book guy as the collector in that Simpsons Halloween episode where he kidnaps Lucy Lawless so he can put her between Doctor Who and Yasmin Bleeth.
I don't know who any of
those
people are.
I have no idea either. I'm not a young person. No.
dear listener, as we run away hand in hand from the Eiffel Tower.
I'm flying. What about you?
Don't be ostentatious. We'll see you next week on the planet Chloris. I hope you've eaten your greens. Don't forget, before then, you can find us at bondfinger.com, where we have commentaries for the first five Connery Bond films. You can also find that as Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and Bondfingercast on Twitter. Please follow us on Facebook and iTunes at Flight Through Entirety, flightthroughentirety.com, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. And if you could retweet or reshare this podcast, we would love that. So please do so. Thank you very much. Until next time, I'm just going to go watch City of Death again, because apparently as a child I would watch it three times a week, and that VHS is still holding up.
Did you?
I did. According to my cousin who babysat me, I drove her insane.
Hey.
Until next week, thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones, and Richard Stone. This episode, Crushed with Disappointment, was recorded on the 6th of December, 2015. The next episode will be released on January 31st. I don't know if you're for the city.
Running through Paris, running through France.